to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our multi-county listening area in central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, here with my co-host, Paul Wearson. Hi, Paul.
Hello, Susan, and welcome to all our listeners at home today.
And before we go farther, I want to introduce our guest host, Cornelia Flora, Charles F. Curtis Distinguished Professor of Sociology and Agriculture and Life Sciences, who was with us last week to introduce the concept of community capitals as a way to explore rural communities like those that make up most of our listening area.
And last week, I really enjoyed talking to Professor Flora. She goes by the name of Neil, short for Cornelia. And about the, well, we talked about the way she used the concept of capitals to help us understand where we live and how our towns are changing. So hello, Neil. It's great to have you with us again.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here again. Since this is the beginning of the newly elected state legislature and new county supervisors, Susan and I thought it would be good to explore political capital. I know that you've lined up some recorded interviews and some guests. Before we start, why don't you tell us who we'll hear from later on in the hour?
Well, we're starting off with a short clip from Governor Terry Branstad giving the State of the State address about just a tiny bit of the address, of course, about one of the most controversial things that the newly elected Republican legislature will consider. Then we'll hear a response from Democratic Senator Herman Quernbach and Representative Beth Wessel-Crichel. This is just to set the stage for our phone guest, who will be Bill Peterson, executive director of the Iowa State Association of Counties. This is something that we'll all hear more about later. And then later also, even after that, we'll hear from County Supervisor Lars Olson, giving us an inside view of how the Story County supervisors work together across party lines.
And Neil will be guiding us through our exploration of county politics, one manifestation of what she calls political capital.
That's right. Political capital is when local people's norms and values are turned into standards. That is to say, this is what should be because this is basically what we believe strongly together. And then those standards are turned into rules and regulations, often through laws. So political capital, when we're looking at it in terms of rural communities, looks at the principle of subsidiarity, which says the norms and values and rules and regulations that make sense at the local level are those that should be applied whenever possible.
Okay. Well, we'll hear more about that later. But let's hear from Governor Branstad.
On my first trip to China in 1984, I learned that the Chinese word for danger and opportunity is one and the same. Today, America and Iowa exist in a challenging world. We must seize the opportunity to make it a better place. In 2010, Lieutenant Governor Reynolds and I promised to reduce the size and scope of government. I'm proud to report that we do have a smaller, smarter government. With a steady focus on improving services for our citizens in a more timely and efficient manner. Yet while the size of government is smaller, the benefits for public employees at the state and local level have increased. Unfortunately, the cost of these benefits have grown dramatically because of our antiquated collective bargaining system that has led to over 500 health care plans, many of which are inefficient and way too costly for public employees and Iowa taxpayers. Under our present system, just a few adverse health outcomes can destroy the budget of a city, county, or school district. By replacing this system with one comprehensive statewide contract, we can spread the risk and dramatically reduce the costs. Using a uniform health care benefit system similar to the IPRS program for retirement, we can provide quality health care at a significantly lower cost and give local governments more flexibility to provide better wages and meet other needs. The statewide health care contract also needs to reward employees who take ownership of their own health by conducting health risk assessments and taking actions to improve their own health. We have made a commitment to examine each and every dollar of revenue and expenditure in order to maximize efficiency and respect our hardworking taxpayers. We are committed to a smaller and smarter government that seeks innovative ways to provide services rather than blind adherence to the way things have always been done.
And that was Governor Terry Branstad in his Condition of the State address, proposing an alteration to Chapter 20 of the Iowa Code concerning collective bargaining rights. The proposal is to take health care out of the negotiations between local government entities, including school boards and the unions representing workers, and put in its place a statewide health care plan for public employees. At the League of Women Voters Forum on Saturday, Democratic Senator Herman Quirnbach and Representative Beth Wessel-Crichel were asked what they made of this proposal.
I'll be brief. This is the guy who gave us Medicaid privatization. Okay? I remember a Chamber of Commerce survey a few years back. The five largest employers in Ames, and I think it was seven of the top ten, are public sector. I think everybody in this community who depends on, you know, a public employer for health care protection should be very, very worried about that proposal. Beth?
I share Senator Quirnbach's concerns. I think I want health care for all Iowans. And this proposal, in my opinion, is putting health care for public employees at a very high risk. It's also taking away from local interests that are providing insurance for us. For example, the Atlantic School District goes through a local insurance agent to get their health care for their school districts. And it allows for a lot of local control. It also allows for, you know, if you look back at negotiating history, how many times the groups have said, we want good health insurance and we will forego a raise. And so they have forgone a lot of income to make sure they have strong health care. There are many people in rural Iowa who are working. They are farmers and they work an extra job to provide health care. And that's the number one reason they are working that job. So by putting it at risk in any sense is wrong.
Well, that is the voices from the state level. And now we're going to look at counties and the issues of local control and the issues that the counties have to deal with. And health care is an important, very, very important issue, which actually could fill a whole program. But the counties, except for collective bargaining with their employees, it's an important issue for them, but their businesses are primarily some other issues, and we'll be talking about those. Neil, could you talk just a little about the structure of county government here in Iowa and how it might differ from some of the others?
Well, the county government in Iowa was formed basically far before we were a state, that we had the immigrants came to Iowa coming basically from the northeast of the United States and some directly from Europe as the railroads crossed the country and brought new people. The people that came to Iowa were people who had come from a tradition of collective governments, often through their churches. And so they came and said, we need schools, we need roads, we need to figure out how to make these happen, and they understood you have to pay for these, so they figured out ways to tax themselves to support schools for everyone, roads that everyone could use. And this is manifested later on in Iowa, where you see so many public golf courses rather than private golf courses. The notion of being, we can make these decisions to make life better for all of us collectively and support them collectively. So this notion of decentralization, the notion of subsidiarity, we make the decisions closest to those people who will be affected, was borne out in how we established our governments here in Iowa and basically the Midwest.
Well, this is a very proud heritage, and it's a big part of our cultural capital, that attitude. I grew up in a small town also, and I know that I always had the attitude, if you want something, if you want a theater, you call people together and you form a little theater group. And that happened to be my interest, so I wasn't interested in the golf courses, but I'm sure that that this is the way that most towns got what they got. So,
and one of the other powers that was given to local governments, because this is what they thought was most important, was land use. Determining land use, words like zoning, words like these kinds of things were important because we should do this for the collective good, so that you didn't say you must build this here. You would just say, this land is reserved for a school. This is where we will have our business district. And that was seen as serving the greater good and decisions that should be made locally by local people and discussed by local people before these decisions were implemented.
So now let's move from the town sites to the counties. And now, with 100 counties in Iowa, I guess we've had those. Have we had those from the beginning, the 100 counties?
No, the county sizes have changed. County seats have changed. But they were negotiated locally. Sometimes one part of a county said, no, we don't want to be part of those people. So they formed their own county, which meant taking on the extra expense it would be to have county governments, but feeling it was appropriate because, remember, if deciding rules and regulations is part of norms and values of those people, there was that feeling that maybe we should be together.
Well, it sounds like there needs, even today, especially today maybe, a lot of cooperation and management among those counties. And we have Bill Peterson here with us from the Iowa State Association of Counties to answer some questions. Is that right, Greta? Is he on the line? Hi,
yep,
Bill.
I'm on the line.
Hey, Bill, this is Paul Wirtz, and I'm joining you too. How are you?
I'm good.
Good. Well, we just need to get some background and basic questions answered about what the Iowa State Association of Counties is all about. And you might brief us on what is the mission of this organization and tell us about it.
Well, first of all, somebody mentioned that there were 100 counties in Iowa, and I wish there were, because
99
it would
counties.
Make a division of averages a lot easier.
It would be an even number.
Unfortunately, we quit at 99 counties, so we only have 99, which is a pretty nice number, too. It's divisible by 3. So the mission of the Iowa State Association of Counties, primarily, our organizational mission is to work with the 99 counties in the state and provide them any sort of assistance in performing services for the public. Since 1978, counties have had home rule authority, and we received that by a constitutional amendment, which passed by the voters of Iowa in 1978. So now counties look to the Iowa statutes to see what limits them, as opposed to looking to the Iowa statutes to determine what they can do. And they do have quite a bit of freedom in almost every area except taxation, and they're specifically exempted from, counties are specifically exempted from creating a new form of tax that is not authorized someplace in state statute. So,
well, what are some of the issues that your organization, ISAC, helps counties address? Some examples of areas where you've been crucial in helping them to facilitate a solution or a difficult issue comes up. Can you think of some examples of where you were a resource for them in that way?
As an association, we do a number of educational programs. We keep our members informed about legislative issues. So, for example, in the current state legislature, there's discussion about whether or not the state will reduce the amount of backfill for some property tax reform legislation that was passed in 2013. There's a proposal that we've heard rumbling around that would reduce that backfill by about $24 million.
Now, by backfill, do you mean money that would go back to the counties from, because the state collects the taxes?
So in 2013, in some property tax reform legislation, they rolled back the taxable value of commercial and industrial properties. And so the net impact of that to not only counties, but to cities and schools and other entities that rely on property tax was about, I believe, $175 million. And so as this taxable value was rolled back, that reduced the amount of tax revenue that counties and cities and schools could collect directly from property taxpayers. So the state agreed to replace that with state revenues so that there would not be a fiscal shortfall. So currently the discussion is that since the state has to cut about $100 million, that this would be one place that the legislature could reduce their expenditures by cutting back the amount that they replaced in that revenue.
That counties and school districts and cities and towns would bear the brunt of the failure of the state to raise taxes in an appropriate fashion?
Yes, I suppose you could put it that way. The cities, counties, and schools will bear the brunt of that fiscally, but it's a result of reducing the property tax valuations on commercial and industrial properties. So there will be taxpayers in those categories that benefit from that rollback. But
how many of them will live in Iowa from that rollback?
Well,
like Walmart and Lowe's?
So it would be any company that is located in Iowa that is paying commercial or industrial property tax.
They would have to have
a real property located in the state, and so it wouldn't make any difference where the headquarters of that business was,
where that tax saving went to. I guess my point is,
right,
these decisions are made not taking into account. So part of your role, I would assume, would be to point out to the legislature, if you make these wonderful savings for businesses, where will that money go and how will it benefit Iowa, particularly the things that the private sector does not provide, such as schools, roads, hospitals, water systems. Is that part of your role, is to instruct the legislature on the local impacts of their decisions that they feel are business friendly, but those businesses are not Iowa businesses?
Yes. Well, our role would be to point out to the legislature the implications of those tax reductions, and that what happens is that counties and cities and schools are left with the decision to either raise taxes on other taxpayers to cover those costs, or to reduce the services that they are providing and to account for that revenue loss. So, you know, the property tax, the taxable valuation rollback was a benefit to those taxpayers who have commercial and industrial interests in Iowa. So how they use that money, you know, there's no way that we know how they use that money. But theoretically, I know that you've heard this, if you reduce the tax value, they can expand their business operations. And whether they do that in Iowa or not, you know, that's obviously a question that economists argue about all the time.
Well, I mean, what we know, what we know about those, particularly those corporations that own a large portion of the businesses in Iowa, frankly, now we're losing our local restaurants and they're going to chains, is that the first and foremost goal of any corporation is to value for its stockholders, not its employees, not the communities where they live. So we've certainly increased the value of their stocks. But have you asked the legislature to trace the impact of this?
We've lost Bill Peterson.
Yes, well, we've lost Bill Peterson.
Neil, you're making some very important points that I think need to be expanded on. You know, it just seems that the question always is a balance. What's the public good? What's the best for all people? How far do you go to incentivize business, and at what expense?
Well, and the other question is, any policy is a hypothesis. It says, if we do this, we think this will happen. And the only way we can test those hypotheses is by measuring the impacts. So my question would be, to what degree is the state, who drastically cut the revenue of state or county and local government, monitoring what has happened as a result? We know that it's harder and harder for rural schools to maintain themselves. We know it's harder and harder to keep teachers. We know now that suddenly we're going to further cut the benefits that have been negotiated. Yeah. So what are we going to do about that?
Well, yeah, that's a big question. And the other thing is, I'm a history nut. So what's the history when you do this or do that? We should learn from what policies have been employed in the past.
Yes, I mean that we do have evidence, and this is a question of what scientists are we using. Certainly, I don't believe the sociology department, where we have people who really look at the impact of policy, was consulted on this at Iowa State. Perhaps the economics department, David Swenson, was consulted, but what I fear is these policies that look like they're going to be great for business, and by golly, if I was a stockholder, I'd be thrilled to get more money back because that increases the value of my stock. But what does it do to local people? And the governor in his comments kept talking about, well, we've got to save money. Well, sometimes, and they keep saying, well, that's what you do in a family. You know what happens in a family is when you're short of money, sometimes you go out and take another job. Then, in other words, you look for sources of revenue as well as simply, how do I cut the budget?
Exactly. And so, and that's anathema to a lot of people to raise taxes in any way. So you're left with a shrinking revenue source and ever-increasing costs, and the complications of not supporting institutions like schools and other public services have a cumulative effect. You're talking about attracting and keeping teachers, the quality of our water. You could just go across the board and say what things that are normally spent for the public good are impacted when we shift resources to another area, like incentivizing business.
Well, you know? And again, and it would be wonderful if we could have done things to help keep locally owned and locally run businesses in place. But we have done, clearly one of the things that our policies are doing is closing locally owned businesses and opening up chains that frankly probably are less loyal to their workers, certainly have no particular interest in that community, and will close down if corporate sees that they can make more money elsewhere. We've had a couple of businesses, corporate businesses, now closed down in Ames for that reason. So, I mean, I think we really have to go beyond the low-tax ideology.
Yeah.
To saying, what is the public good? How else will we pay for it? And to say we're going to pay for it by taking away workers' benefits, by not letting unions, local unions, negotiate their local contract with their local governments and employers, we're going to have, again, who wins, who gets the money, and who takes it in the neck in terms of decreased healthcare availability, increased health care costs for the individual. But, hey, according to the governor, if the state saves money, that's the most important thing.
I have to say, I think part of this goes to a phrase that Governor Branstad used in his address, when he talked about the hardworking taxpayers. And I thought, well, the hardworking taxpayers who are sending their profits out of state will have their taxes cut. And I don't think most Iowans with our realize that we're paying for somebody else's interest, not for our community. This is KHOI Community Radio. We've been listening to Bill Peterson, Executive Director of the Iowa State Association of Counties, in conversation with Cornelia Flora. Before we hear from next, we will hear from Story County Supervisor Lars Olson. And she really takes it to the ground. I mean, she takes it to us locally, and she deals with one of the most important issues that face most counties now, and that is the sighting of
animal confinement operations.
Yes. Yeah. And the matrix, and also how do county boards of supervisors get things done? How do they work together? And she is in a county where there are two Republican supervisors, and she's the new Democrat, and she talks a little bit about how they work together and how they work on their common interests.
And she is one of the supervisors.
And she's a brand new, newly elected supervisor, but she's also a journalist, so she has been following these issues for a long time. And could we hear what Loris has to say?
Loris Olson, you are a Democrat on Story County Board of Supervisors alongside two Republicans. Let's talk about the role of county government in the face of one-party state government, or what role do you see the county as having potentially in such a situation?
Okay. First, let's go back to the fact I am the Democrat with two Republicans. And when you're on such a small board like this, it takes time to develop the relationships to figure out just where even each of my Republican co-workers are on the scale of how much local control they think should be appropriate versus how much state control. And I think we've found just all of us through the years, and as we watch the state legislature, is they'll give you local control on one thing because they don't want to deal with it, and then they want to pull local control on another issue because it's to the benefit to deal with it. The three of us are still working out where the boundaries are as far as political parties, and really political parties haven't come into it yet. It's more about the individual philosophies that I think put us within those parties.
What are you finding about your colleagues' concept of local control versus yours?
I think that the issues that we've already dealt with, the first one has been approving the master matrix. And
this is confinement.
Confinements. And the state law is set up for confinement operations in that the counties don't really have local control. The only thing they give us is if we agree to play by certain rules, we will be allowed to use a scoring matrix, and anyone who wants to open or expand a animal feeding confinement operation in our county has to score so many points on this matrix. And all these points are above what the DNR requires. So that's the carrot that the state legislature put out to us, several years ago to try and move process through and still allow confinement feeding operations. The problem is if you agree to use that matrix, then you also agree that if someone, or in theory agree, that if someone scores the minimum 440 points by your assessment and their assessment of what the standards are to meet these points, then you should be voting yes for the confinement. And if you don't vote yes, the DNR has the ability to come in and say, sorry, county, but even though you're using the matrix, you're not using it in good faith because you're voting no on all of them, for a philosophical reason, and so we're pulling the matrix from you. Last fall, I believe it was in November, the Iowa Association of Counties have meetings twice a year, kind of where for all, the statewide, and they brought in the gentleman at the DNR that is responsible for dealing with confinement operations, and he gave a seminar, and it was interesting to listen to him talk about this, the whole process, and that's where I picked up. Never before had I truly understood that there were a few areas that we could affect the requirements. And that's something that's new that's come up, and I think that the other two people on our current Story County board also were, oh, wait a minute, you mean we can set some minimum requirements on some of these? So that was good. So now back to the Sarah Goder case, he didn't reference that particularly, but he did point out there had only been a few cases where the DNR had upheld a scoring disagreement when it was close. And I think that feeds into what you're asking. We'll have to see now what happens next. I know for me personally, I've already said that I would like to see us pass a resolution in support of a letter similar to what the Webster County Board of Supervisors did, which is when they went to this meeting last November, December, they took a letter down and introduced it to their fellow supervisors, in where it pointed out problems with the matrix, pointed out the need for local control.
Was this a letter to the Iowa DNR kind of in protest of the situation?
Yeah, they sent it along with a confinement operation that they had been, if you will, forced to approve because there was no disagreement about the scoring areas that the applicant had chosen. And just to remind your listeners that while there are these 880 points that anyone who wants to open or expand a confinement operation has to score against if they want to go into a county where the matrix is being used. They only need to get 440 of those points, and they get to pick which items to get the 440. So the counties don't even get to dictate which ones you will meet. The counties don't even get to say, these are important in our county, whether maybe one county focuses more on water quality because of their watershed issues. Another county maybe would like to focus more on air quality because of the communities around where people are usually opening them, or, you know, all of these issues, but we don't get control over that. The applicant gets to choose. And so then our only, a county's only opportunity is to go in and look very closely at, of the items that are chosen, did they in fact meet the qualifications?
So Webster County went in and said to the DNR, this isn't fair. We should have the right to choose what's important to us.
Well, they went in general, and that was one of several items they listed on their letter about the process. They were saying, we're getting too many of these, and we're not having any control over it. And therefore, in general, we want control, but if you're we're going to have to continue with the master matrix, these are the things we would like to see addressed to help us really truly be given control back.
And of course, Webster County is affected by the new Eagle Grove processing plant, or the anticipation of one.
They're right next door.
Yeah.
Right.
So in a way, you're saying that county government can find those areas where there is power and then utilize the power.
Yes, and we didn't really know that before. So from a local control standpoint, with this, the Story County Board of Supervisors, on this issue about confinement operations, we had a discussion on January 3rd. Normally, in several years past, the previous board had just put it on the consent agenda. But I was told in advance by our chairman, Rick Sanders, who is our experienced member on the board. Marty Chitty is only 6 months on the board. He was a special appointment and then elected, and then I was elected. Rick told me that he was going to pull it for discussion, in part because he knew that I really didn't want any more confinement operations in the county, and many and some of my supporters had been very vocal about it and had asked, even in forums, would I introduce a moratorium for the county, or would I support a state moratorium? And I kept on saying, I'm afraid we'll lose the matrix if we don't handle this correctly. But so we had a discussion on January 3rd, and I did vote for the matrix, because as weak as it is and ineffective for long-term goals, I think both for the producers and for citizens who are worried about issues like water quality, it's all we've got.
Yeah, what's the alternative to the matrix if you had voted no, if the county had voted no to a
the
matrix?
Applications would have gone to the DNR. The DNR would have determined if they met the minimum DNR standards, and they would not have been required to meet any of these additional safety or air quality or water quality items that are on the matrix.
So that's really for counties that don't want a lot of controversy in their decision-making rooms. They don't want citizens coming up and complaining.
Okay, that's one way to put it. If you look at it from, you know, that perspective, the other one would be is giving them the benefit of the doubt. They don't feel that they have the expertise or the staff. Story County has really taken the forefront of this with the previous board. We went from just having our environmental health director be in charge of this matrix to forming an interagency team that even includes a member of the Story County Planning and Zoning Commission on it. And that team now takes their areas of expertise to help evaluate that, so that we've got a well-rounded approach. Even when it would come before the Board of Supervisors, we've had several eyes look on this to see, did they in fact meet what was on the paper? Now we know that in things like the example that's always given, air filters, we can set the standard for the air filter. Rather than just saying an air filter and some of these exhaust systems are using no different filter than what we put in our own heat, you know, our own furnaces, basically, big ones, but they're still that. But we can set a biofilter standard. So what's happening right now from that discussion on January 3rd, our lead person on the interagency team, Margaret Janes, the environmental health director, she suggested, and I strongly supported, and Rick Sanders said, yes, I think this is a good idea, and Marty Chitty weighed in. Marty grew up in eastern Nevada, and Marty lives on a farm. So, as a member of Farm Bureau, which is a group that's very instrumental in getting the matrix set up with it being a benefit toward, so much toward the producers and away from local control. And, we've all agreed, yeah, we should do a workshop on this. So Margaret is right now trying to figure out which one of the items we will actually be able to provide input on. I'm meeting with her next week to go over those items. I believe Marty wants to meet with her. If two of us meet, we have to have an open meeting, and we're not ready for the workshop for the open meeting. We're just still gathering information. And then we're planning on the end of the month having an actual workshop. And I'm already putting out the word to some people I know who are interested in this. And in fact, when I knew that we were going to discuss it on January 3rd as an agenda item rather than just consent, I immediately put out the word to some people that I knew would be interested, would be able to help weigh in on what is it exactly that if we were able to impact those requirements, what should we be impacting?
Okay. Do you know how many applications we have had for confinement since, say, 2014, which when there was a confinement put up in Nevada, rural
right.
Nevada, the
mm-hmm.
Chemland?
There have been none. I believe if you go back, the Chemland was the last one. It is my understanding, I have not spoken to this person, but I believe the other two supervisors, he's been in contact with the other two supervisors individually, that there is a gentleman who's looking, or a family, putting up one south of Nevada, and the application will come to us probably in March. I believe that he's been told by the chairman already that as you look at our schedules for February and early March, there may be possibilities when some of us aren't at board meetings. Just it seemed like that's just how we've all worked out, that there will be some, and that there's no way that we would entertain looking at an application if all three of us weren't there.
Well, that was Loris Olson, our new Story County supervisor, talking about one of the big issues that the Story County will be dealing with. Now, we have just a few minutes before the end of the hour, and not enough to bring you Dick Steffen. So we'd like to talk about some of the issues, since we have Neil Flora here, that are important for local control. What do the counties, why is county government important?
One of the things that the master matrix brings out and the conflicts over it, and why at one point actually the legislature voted to have counties have that decision-making power and was vetoed by the governor, who was a Democrat, Chet Culver, that the thing about Iowa and counties is people think of Iowa as very homogeneous. It is not. We are not homogeneous in terms of our people, and we are certainly not in terms of our land. Counties have different soils, different hydrologies, different slopes, different ways of managing, and what is really important in terms of water and soil and air is that those people closest to those necessities of life make collective decisions about what is acceptable and what is not. It doesn't mean you tell the farmer what to do, but it does mean you make decisions about do you start a new operation or don't you? Because how the density of CAFOs, confined animal feeding operations, makes a huge difference in terms of air quality, water quality, soil quality. So it's just sort of keeping these things in mind. And it also means the power to not only have norms and standards and rules and regulations, but to enforce them. And our problem is we have very good water standards in Iowa, universal water standards, but we don't enforce them. So the point is rules are only good if they're enforced. And this is also often best done at a local level. Unfortunately, we've said now we depend on whistleblowers or somebody reporting something this horrible is happening before we act on it. The second point that I think is really important to make is that this doesn't say that any particular occupational group or persons are responsible for what goes on. It means we are all responsible. What are ways that we can make sure that our agricultural producers make a dignified living? As was pointed out, they often, to get benefits, they're a member of the family, works often in a state or local government, so they can get benefits, which are now going to be cut according to proposed policy. How do we make sure that people can live with dignity, can breathe the air, can drink the water, and can get along with their neighbors? And these are things that we can best do on a local level. One of the things I wanted to point out is that we are very lucky in Iowa. I can't come from the state of California. This is a very large state. It has very large counties. And it means that your county supervisors have very little contact with most of their populations. Iowa has reasonable sized counties, 99 rather than 100. And California, as I recall, and I apologize for not having this right, I think it's around 30 or 39. So that makes county government very different in those two places. I grew up in a place called Kern County, where the city of Bakersfield is. We were on the other side of the mountains from Bakersfield, and county government didn't mean much for what we were doing at all. But here we are closer. We need to realize that we have to work together, rural and urban, and our county supervisors, this very important body of good people, are how we work together to make sure we're all living here, both in sharing our values that we share and maintaining the quality of life for everyone in the county.
Well, I really like your statement about there's nothing more local than land. And so how is that land to be used? And the other thing that I always think of in the back of my mind when you're talking about government or decisions or choices, the constant question I ask is, what is the common good? Mm-hmm. How do we ascertain that and agree upon what that common good is and what kind of policy follows that rule? What's going to happen for the best for the people who live locally? And there are probably people who think that a 99-county system is obsolescent, but in reality, as you say, it gives the best shot at local control to have counties that size.
Yes, and this is one of the other things we have below the counties are towns and townships. We are finding now that many, and they're called incorporated places, and they're incorporated because local people got together and say, we want to have a governing body that makes the rules for us where we live. As they get smaller and as their income declines, and we've already understood why their income is declining and why it's going to decline a lot more, places are unincorporating. They're saying, no, we want the county to provide these services for us. We will follow the county rules. We will have the sheriff here. We won't have our own police department. We'll be on county water. We won't have our own city. So as this is happening, it's even more important that we have strong and active county governments and that they are funded appropriately.
Reporter Greta Anderson's conversation with Loris Olson touched on the issue that we began the hour with. Branstad's proposal in the condition of the state address to remove healthcare bargaining from the collective bargaining rights of county and other governmental employees and put in its place a statewide health care system. We'll end our show with Loris's take on that.
We don't even know really what he's proposing. He just wants to use one. I do think from a philosophy of the party that often talks about how competition is so good, it's valuable, it brings the price down, to go to one statewide seems to be the antithesis of that particular philosophy that's been expounded. Now, we're just standing back and watching. We as Story County, again, the supervisors and like the HR and most of the department heads, and certainly I think the members of our five unions are sitting back and watching right now. What exactly are they thinking of? Are they going to do away with Chapter 20 entirely? Or are they going to go in and modify Chapter 20? Everybody's focused on the health care because I think certainly for the state workers, that impacts them greatly. Dave has said it's going to happen. We're going to look at Chapter 20, and there will be changes. Now, how various counties react, how Story County reacts, we've got the five unions. I think that we'll be meeting with our attorney, our bargaining attorney, around February 9th. I think the meeting is set for to discuss if any unions are want to approach us about maybe extending their contracts or renegotiating their contracts. Because we are anticipating that anything put in place won't be or couldn't be retroactive. So if you're looking at them moving quickly on this, them being the state legislature and then enacting on July 1, we've got five unions that I'm sure would like to talk to us. And so I have no interest whatsoever in removing what we have given the unions. I'm sure that but then the other two supervisors get to weigh in also. And there's always can be adjustments in, the amount of a raise. As I said, our insurance that we offer right now, I thought was a pretty good plan for a county plan, but they don't have choices of various companies. If the state makes us all go with one company, that could be a problem. This is a hugely significant thing that I think some citizens don't think about. They think, oh, it's public unions and I don't have to worry about it. I'm not in the public sector and I am not employed, I'm not unionized, but this can impact how we are able to compensate our workers. And we could lose some workers, some people with valuable knowledge to private industry.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in central Iowa. We've been your hosts, Susan Franzen and Paul Wearson. Professor Emeritus Cornelia Flora brought special insights to the interview with Bill Peterson of the Iowa State Association for Counties. Other interviews we heard were from Loris Olson, a Story County Supervisor. You also heard the voices of Governor Terry Branstad, State Senator Herman Quernbach, and Representative Beth Wessel-Crichel.
Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon at 7 p.m. today. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past local shows online at our website, khoyfm.org. Thanks to Ron Carson for taking care of the technical details of these posts with information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories.
Local Talk was engineered by Greta Anderson. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
Well, Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. And if you would like to join our team as a reporter, just contact us at 515-292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoyfm.org.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and See you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.